My education in intellectual history connects me to the so-called Cambridge School. I went out to research on the Scottish Enlightenment in the late 80s to King's College Cambridge, where I worked with István Hont. And that was quite crucial for my formation, because I think that that in fact political philosophy gains a lot by connecting it with the history of political thought in the more historical sense that the Cambridge School kept emphasizing.
Welcome to another installment of New Work in Intellectual History. I'm Ogel Rodriguez, and today we are joined by Professor Ferenc Hoxha, who has written a wonderful book on Sir Roger Scruton's philosophy called Art and Politics in Roger Scruton's Conservative Philosophy for Palgrave Macmillan. Professor Hoxha is head and research professor of the Research Institute of Politics and Government in the National University of Public Service in Hungary. He is also a senior research fellow of the Institute of Philosophy of the Hungarian Academy of Science. His most recent publications include A Political Philosophy of Conservatism, Prudence, Moderation, and Tradition, The Political Philosophy of the European City, For Polis Through City-State to Megalopolis, and also a collected volume co-edited with Thomas Lohrmann called A History of the Hungarian Constitution, Law, Government, and Political Culture in Central Europe. Welcome, Professor.
Well, I'm very happy to be here, and thank you for the invitation.
Let's start. There has been always a kind of popular interest on Sir Rogers, but in the academic sphere, it has not been reciprocated as much, unless you study the work of Professor Mark Dooley, who early on took in this strong academic interest on Roger Scruton's philosophy. Can I ask you what has spurred this general academic interest on Sir Roger Scruton's philosophy, and also your personal interest that led to the writing and publication of this great book?
Yes, well, you are right that Scruton, while he has a great volume of output and a real achievements in philosophy, is underrated and not really discussed in the scholarly literature as he should be. And you mentioned Mark Dooley, who indeed published the first volume-length study on him. But I would also mention the name of James Bryson, who edited a volume on the religious philosophy of Roger Scruton. So there were some people who were already interested in his lifetime. And I had the privilege as well to meet him and discuss philosophy, and in fact present papers together with him. So that means that there was this personal element that brought me to his thought. And you should be aware of the fact that I come from the other side of the Iron Curtain, and I'm old enough to have experience of the communist regime that was in control of that part of the world before 1990. And Roger Scruton was one of those exceptional figures who had the courage to come from the Western world to this region to give underground courses as well as to bring new literature to this region for students and colleagues and anyone interested. So I appreciated that as well in his achievements, because I think that that personal courage and risk taking is an important matter in human life. So all given all these factors, and maybe one more aspect might be mentioned that brought me to the decision that I would like to write a monograph on him. And that is that his education and my educational background is quite parallel. His PhD was on aesthetics, on epistemology, philosophy of mind in aesthetics, but he turned from there to politics and then back again to aesthetics. So aesthetics and politics come quite close to him as far as his background, philosophical background is concerned. And my own philosophical education was also in these two fields. So that's again something that made it an obvious and a natural choice for me to deal with his work.
Yes, his underground teaching in communist-controlled Central Europe was so important to him, and it also showcases why there's a more academic and popular interest with Roger Scruton in comparison here in the United Kingdom. You mentioned your connections as a political philosopher, as a philosopher of art. So in what sense writing this book relate to your broader interest in art and politics and your previous books in on the political philosophy of the European city and the political philosophy of conservatism?
Yes, you have to keep in mind that I had the privilege to teach for almost a quarter of a century aesthetics at the Catholic University in Hungary, which means that for me it was the daily routine that I was expected to do, to teach on these topics like the history of aesthetic thought in the early modern period, as well as theoretical approaches to painting and architecture. So these were the things that I did earlier. And in fact, in Hungarian language, I have got a number of publications that are directly connected to that field. But and therefore, it was quite obvious that I was interested in the aesthetics of Scruton. And you know, when you start to think about writing a monograph of a person who has got more than 50 books that he published in his lifetime, then you have to select. You cannot speak about everything because that would take too long. So I had to make a decision, and I decided to focus on this single dimension, on the connection between art and politics in his oeuvre. And that's because I think that in conservatism, this is a crucial dimension. Why? Because as I came to recognize, in fact, there is a very important basic assumption within the conservative philosophical stance, and that is that politics is downstream from culture. In other words, that culture is in a way much more relevant in human life than politics, or is more fundamental. It's not so much more relevant. It's more fundamental. It's something that is determining a lot when you deal with politics. And in that sense, to understand the connections between the two, how politics is based on the culture and the arts, you have to focus on that relationship. And one more thing to add. When Roger speaks about culture and also about art, of course, there are two meanings that he has in mind. One is high culture and you know the peaks of basically Western art, although he was quite familiar with the Islamic world and the culture of it as well, and some other cultures. Most importantly, there is another dimension to culture, which is, one could say, everyday culture or the way of life that a certain community lives. The connection between civilization and culture, that more general sense of the term, which is in play here, and the two things, high art and the peaks of Western achievements and ordinary culture, the everyday culture, are crucial for him and are in his mind when he talks about culture.
This emphasis, and you talk in the book that Sir Roger is presenting a kind of aesthetic conservatism that is based on beauty, the divine, culture. And very interestingly, your introductory chapter begins focusing on the classics with Aristotle and practical activity and practical knowledge, and then you go to Plato. But also you start, interestingly, with Oakeshott. Why start with these three thinkers in order to outline this triangle that you mentioned between philosophy, arts, and politics?
Well, of course, because that is something crucial in Scruton's, if you want to make sense of Scruton's achievements. But also because I think that in order to be able to talk about politics philosophically, you have to realize that you are not the first one to do it, and that you are part of a tradition yourself. You have to position yourself in that tradition, and both Scruton and I myself try to do so, as did, by the way, Oakeshott, who in his lectures on political thought starts with Plato and Aristotle and all the great figures of ancient philosophy. So. That's crucial to see that it is not something that you do out of the blue, but that you belong to this tradition. But there is a further aspect that I try to make crucial in my book, which is the life of the thinker and the thought of the thinker. Vita activa and vita contemplativa. These are two terms that I find crucial for him, because as a political philosopher, he took over actually from the Greeks the idea that when you decide for your philosophy, then you have to realize that what you do is to that you choose a certain way of life. And two things should be in harmony. You cannot think one way and do things differently. So there are these two levels of one's life. If you are a philosopher, you have to be aware that you will always be checked how far your thoughts are correct or your philosophy is true by comparing your thoughts and your deeds. And that's why I think that these two dimensions are crucial. And that is a distinction that comes from the ancients. So I had to start with them. And in fact, in the contemporary context, it was Michael Oakeshott who tried to figure out these different layers of human experience. In his book, Experience and Its Modes, he presents these different layers. Of course, they are not exactly the same that the Plato or Aristotle referred to, but they are on along those lines, that you have to understand that ordinary human thinking is something different than philosophical thought, and in the same time you have to connect the two, as when Aristotle talks about practical decisions, when you try to think rationally and in a universal way, but you throw practical conclusions from them and you act it out. That's the practical syllogism that Aristotle refers to.
I think, and you end that chapter, I think, with an important sentence when you mention that you want to show in Roger Scruton's philosophy that art has a kind of metaphysical relevance to understand human nature. And Sir Roger, if my reading of Sir Roger, he seems to affirm it in his later years. Why does he returns he doesn't give so much emphasis to political commentary like he did, for example, in the 80s when he was the editor of the Salisbury Review, but he returns to art, what he studied in Cambridge. He returns to this idea of art, this connection between art and human nature. Why he returns to those ideas in his later years?
Yes, the sentence that you refer to, of course, prepares the ground for my conclusions. So when you write a book, you know, you are writing a narrative and your reader, and you expect your reader to get through the whole story, starting out from something and arriving somewhere else. And so you start out from this division between practical life and theoretical life, and you end up with having those two closely connected, but also leading you to a third dimension, which is religion. And your beliefs, your final metaphysical beliefs, and in that sense, you have to realize that although culture is upstream from politics, there is something before your culture, and that is your religious belief. Religion is upstream from culture, so in a sense, that's the narrative structure of my book. We start on from this duality or the triad of politics, art, and philosophy, and we end up with the introduction of religion as the determining factor of religion and politics. But in between, we have got a whole life lived with a number of challenges and a number of perhaps good and a number of perhaps bad decisions as well. And as a result, by the end of that life, the philosopher arrives to the moment when he has to make sense of that life. So in that sense, what I'm looking for is the narrative unity of that life, to use a term Alasdair MacIntyre refers to, or Paul Ricoeur also refers to. And when he is doing it, for example, in writing his autobiography or in his interview book with Mark Dooley, but also in the great lecture series, which are published in book format in 2012 and 2014, he addresses some of the largest metaphysical issues of philosophy according to the Greco-Roman and Western Christian tradition, while trying to avoid to shift from philosophy to theology. That's also crucial in Roger's case. And that's something that other philosophers sometimes mistake. They don't recognize the clear-cut division between, or a dividing line between philosophy and religion. He does not cross that border, but tries to address the things from this side of the division line.
I think there is a tension in the case of British conservatism that Anthony Kenton mentioned between a more religiously focused conservatism and a more skeptical focused conservatism. And I think Sir Roger strides between the boundaries. He doesn't fit any of them so easily. But you mentioned Sir Roger's life. And one of the great things about the book is that your second chapter is a kind of intellectual autobiography to understand how his thought came to be. And Sir Roger, in Gentle Regrets and in his book, How to Be a Conservative, and he always harkens back to 1968 in Paris and that deep effect it had on him. But a question that arose from me is, one of my research focuses on Ken Minogue, and he experienced the same troubles in the 60s at LSE. But his response to that was not necessarily to incorporate a kind of aesthetic and cultural social issues into his commentary and research, but to become a public intellectual. Why does the impact on of Paris in 1968 so deep impact Sir Roger that he would incorporate these themes into his thinking, that some conservative, for example, Oakeshott, who experienced the same things at LSE, the same troubles, but he never, for example, became a public intellectual. Why is that 1968 time in Paris so deeply impacted Sir Roger?
Well, you mentioned the term intellectual biography, and with good reason. You have to be aware that my education in intellectual history connects me to the so-called Cambridge School. I went out to research on the Scottish Enlightenment in the late 80s to King's College Cambridge, where I worked with István Hont. And that was quite crucial for my formation, because I think that that in fact political philosophy gains a lot by connecting it with the history of political thought in the more historical sense that the Cambridge School kept emphasizing. So that's why intellectual biography, the contextualization of one's development and the character formation and the influences and the receptions it has is crucial for me. Points that tries to answer your question is that I don't want to say that's I think crucial. I don't want to say that what Scruton represents is a kind of aesthetic conservatism. Not at all. On the contrary, what I try to emphasize is that his thoughts has different topics or directions. Politics is one, and aesthetics or the arts and culture is another. And I also say that those two dimensions are connected in certain ways. But I don't claim that when dealing with politics, he would use the cultural field, or when dealing with culture, he would be interested in politics. No, not at all. That's not what he is doing. And that's crucial, because of course within conservatism there is an aesthetic conservatism which tries to convince us that politics is to find the right the proper the aesthetic choice. But that's not the point that Scruton makes. So in that sense, he is always keeping things intact and distinct. As for 68, you mentioned Minogue and Oakeshott. I think they represent two extremes, and Scruton is somewhere in between. Oakeshott is, of course, belonging to an earlier generation, and he is over all those anxieties of whether to be conservatives or not by 68. But more importantly, he did not have that urge or ambition to try to get involved in politics. And you rightly emphasize that in Minogue's case, it's the opposite. He was quite shocked by 68, but also he had that urge or ambition to become a public intellectual, and he did not want to conflate that with other things like culture and aesthetics. As for Scruton, the way I understand his reaction to 68 is that, in fact, he wanted to understand 68 as Edmund Burke tried to understand 1789. And he actually connects the two or refers to Burke in his own reflections on those events. And what's the connection? The connection is that, in fact, these revolutions come because public intellectuals from the left prepared the ground. So there was actual intellectual work projected into preparing the grounds for the student revolutions, ideologies that could have a direct impact on the way people thought and acted in those years. And he tried to understand them, and that's why he went to the origins of those thoughts, and that's how his book on leftist thinkers comes out. And what's the alternative? What he tries to understand is what is the conservative position, and there he refers to De Gaulle and Paul Valéry, French. It's the history of French cultural and political life. But the point that I want to make is that for him, this interest in French culture was crucial to understand what is happening on the streets of Paris in 68. And that's why he decides that, in fact, politics requires a philosophical understanding, and a philosophical understanding of politics requires to contextualize that politics with an interest in culture, as De Gaulle and Valéry, as opposed to Sartre and Foucault, explained 68, the same way British politics, the pre-Thatcherite period of British politics, requires to understand the British tradition as well as British culture. And for him, Ruskin or Eliot and a number of great writers are also crucial to make sense of that British tradition.
That emphasis that he gives to Britain, but specifically to England with his book England Analogy and England and the Need of Nations, as I understood it, it seems that his practical study of law also helped deepen his connections with the importance of common law and the common law tradition for the identity of England and this idea that we need to be attached to England. In that sense, can you expand a little bit more on that influence of his practical? Because one thing that surprised me, I didn't know this before reading your book, was that it was not a kind of a study of law in a more academic sense, but a more practical sense. Can you expand on that aspect of Sir Roger's intellectual journey?
Yes, of course. That's a very important point that we need to understand, that in the British tradition, law and the connection between law and politics is different from, Roman law countries like France. And that is crucial if we want to understand the British politics, early modern and modern politics, why Britain becomes such a great example for European nations. And the claim is that the common law of England, and in this respect it's indeed England and not Britain, because of course Scotland has its own tradition of law, which is much closer to the Roman law. So the thing is that with common law, you have a different tradition, which helps you to understand the importance of precedence. And the importance of precedence is closely connected to the idea of conservatism, because precedence requires you to learn your tradition. It's not enough to know the presently relevant or valid norms of your legal system. You also have to know its past, because the precedents will determine the individual cases in common law. So, in fact, Scruton's decision to learn the law in the Inns of Court, as opposed to the law schools of the universities, helped him to understand legal practice, and within legal practice, this conservative dimension. We are not aware today, because present-day lawyers are very different from traditional lawyers who were educated in that practical model, because the Inns of Courts is crucially controlled by the lawyers themselves. They teach the next generation of lawyers. So in that way, Scruton understood much better his tradition, and he understood much better the conservative dimension of that tradition based on precedents, and also why lawyers are in fact much more traditionally minded professionals than for example in the European context.
That influence of his study of law, I think it's seen best in the meaning of conservatism, that has a very rich legal vocabulary in his explanation of conservatism. In relation to that book, one of the interesting things that I noted there in his book is a kind of he sees to see that what has been happening in the 1970s with the movement of the new right, I think he believes that, and he affirms this in the preface, that it has misconstrued what conservatism is. And so he wants to dissociate conservatism from free market liberalism that seems to be dominating much of the political conservative discourse that was dominating in the new right, and then with Margaret Thatcher, and also a more emphasis on the nation. Could you elaborate why does he feel that he needs to publish such a important treatise on conservatism within this intellectual context of a rising new right and the dominance of the Thatcher administration?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think that we have to realize the importance of the Thatcherite breakthrough in 79. This is something which is in a way unexpected, and on the other hand, which was prepared by certain tendencies, like, for example, Friedrich Hayek, who at LSE had a major impact and who, in fact, connected the Anglo-Saxon world, the British and the American movement towards this breakthrough, because the Thatcherite movement was paralleled by the Reagan's administration's breakthrough. And both of them are based on this assumption that, in fact, what is required is to free the economy from the centralized tendencies that Hayek cautions us against, and therefore for Thatcher, Hayek is the per definition intellectual leader for understanding what is at stake with her movement, and therefore It is indeed a kind of a classical liberal position, updated for the late 20th century. And Scruton is definitely not satisfied with that. We mentioned his reference to Burke. His understanding of the conservative tradition is a more fundamental one than this sort of classical liberal argument for free trade and free institutions and small state. What he wants to present in meaning of conservatism is an alternative vision of the conservative agenda. And it is a direct criticism of the Thatcherite regime. And this is crucial. So he is, as we mentioned, he was an underground figure in the Central European context in the same time. But he positions himself as a kind of an internal opposition within the Thatcher regime as well. And that's why I found it very interesting that he asks his publisher to send the piece to Margaret Thatcher. And she receives it and she responds to Scruton. I gave a talk about that in the House of Lords recently, in which I tried to work out how that correspondence went. And the thing is that Thatcher actually realize that there is a new voice here and a very powerful one, but she did not want to make any difference in her own position, and she did not need the young and ambitious philosopher, so she does not offer anything for him. And that's I think crucial. So she also realized that this is something else than what she wants to do. And in fact, Scruton's the meaning of conservatism that Scruton proposes is one which is based on the same sort of understanding of the human condition as Hayek gives, but which draws different conclusions as far as the institutional frameworks are concerned, and as far as the function of politics in human life are concerned. And I think that you can summarize it this difference the following way, that in fact what you need according to Scruton's conservatism is a kind of richer understanding of the impact of culture on the human being, and in that sense religion, family, and the ways of life of the community is crucial. Famously, Thatcher denies even the existence of society. So in that sense, the classical liberal position talks about the individual. But for Roger, according to the Aristotelian classical tradition, but also in accordance with Burkean understanding of the small platoons, the modern condition is against the individual, and therefore you have to somehow strengthen the individual, and those communities like the family, like the religious community, like the local neighborhood, and the school. These are local communities that need to be taken seriously, and that the politics need to take into account in order to have a more flourishing community.
That connection with Thatcher is so interesting, and I'm glad you mentioned that Sir Roger sent a copy. And from the Thatcher papers, I don't see a confirmation that she actually read it, just that she received it. But Sir Roger was one of the founders of the conservative philosophy group in the 70s, and he was certainly a prominent speaker, and Mrs. Thatcher would sometimes go to those meetings. So it would be very interesting if there was a kind of impact of Sir Roger on Mrs. Thatcher's whole out, a little bit of her outlook on politics and conservatism. Do you think there is any kind of impact between those, that interaction between Sir Roger and Lady Thatcher within the conservative philosophy group?
Before answering that, just to clarify what I wanted to say about the correspondence, in the letter that that we find in the archive, the Thatcher archive, she writes that she wants to read it as soon as she will have time enough for that. Which means that, indeed, as you said, she hasn't read it yet, but she was aware of the importance of it for herself. If we don't take it just a rhetorical device, but why should we in a private letter? So in that sense, I think she actually had a look at it, even though she did not have the opportunity to read it yet. But I don't think that either of them really took the other too importantly. that's the funny thing. We understand that that the prime minister cannot deal with all the philosophers, even of her own side either. But Roger had very skeptical views on politics. That's the other point that you have to understand. Conservative politicians are quite skeptical about intellectuals. That's one side. That's the Thatcher side. On the other hand, Scruton, as a conservative intellectual, or an intellectual conservative, one should be careful to use these terms, because one explains a politician, the other one an intellectual. So from his point of view, politicians are really for nothing as far as philosophy is concerned, because that's not their field. They are not educated in it, and they are not interested in it. So he does not really care about Thatcher's theoretical claims or whatever. That's not interesting for him. What he is interested in is the politics that comes out from the Thatcher regime, and for which she is, of course, responsible. And interestingly, during her years in power, Scruton's position comes closer to Thatcher than it began. So in a way, he starts to appreciate both the difficulties of the endeavor and some of the achievements that he finds, and also that as opposed to intellectuals who in the academia were all against Thatcher, Roger always tried to distinguish himself and was very skeptical about his colleagues at the university, as were they about him as well. And therefore, he wanted to take a different position, and maybe that positioned him closer to Thatcher in the second part of her career as a prime minister.
That's important, because in a certain sense, Roger Scruton answers Maurice Collins' call in conservative essays to expand conservative political discourse. But in his many editorials in the Salisbury Review, he comes back to a kind of limited politics. There's a limited legitimate place for political action. And if I could reference one, there is I think it's March 1990 edition of the Salisbury Review, he's giving advice to Eastern European politicians, and he says, well, you have to depoliticize society. So I think many people don't emphasize that Sir Roger believed in a kind of limited practical politics, and because they see this cultural and social and aesthetic commentary and scholarship, but don't consider that Sir Roger himself understood that there's a legitimate limited area for legitimate political action.
So, yes, that's very crucial, and I think that's what is really conservative about him, and that's why you have to distinguish that from the public intellectual on the left. And let me give you one example. I had the occasion to interview him on Hungarian politics, on Central European and Hungarian politics, and of course Viktor Orbán was one of the topics that came up. And although he appreciated a lot of the efforts of Orbán, he was also quite critical on certain points, both publicly and also in the private conversation which followed the interviews. And I think that shows you that he had an independent stance. So he was not someone who wanted to prepare arguments for politicians in a servile manner. On the contrary, he had self-confidence of the thinker who is aware of the relevance of thought as opposed to the power of the politician, and he thinks that I have got a long-term perspective, he or she a short-term one, and they are two fields and you should never mix them up.
It's very interesting because some of the commentary when he died doesn't take into account these ideas and how he was certainly was not uncritical of the Orbán government, and he had an independent mind and he would defend what he believed to be correct and the legitimate sense of political actions. One final question on his conservatism. One of the interesting things is that there appears to be a large gap between his meaning of conservatism and his another longer treatise on conservatism. Could you talk to us why this long gap between the meaning of conservatism and his book, A Political Philosophy, Arguments for Conservatism in 2006, was the intellectual and political context that he experienced in Britain? I understand that he had returned from the United States by that time. Was the intellectual and political context that spurred him on to reaffirm conservatism in that book, the conservatism that he believed in?
Mm-hmm. Well, my position is in this respect somewhat surprising, perhaps, because I think that although Scruton is one of the crucial thinkers of our age as far as conservatism is concerned, his books on conservatism are less than satisfactory. So I don't think that that he has got a major one-volume summary of what conservatism consists of. Sorry, and that's something that we have to keep in mind, and maybe that's connected also to the nature of conservatism. You cannot just summarize it in a textbook what conservatism consists of, and you have got 10 chapters and 10 theses, and that's it. In some ways, it's something which is developing, which is always changing forms. And in that respect, you always have to update your thoughts. So there are shifts and changes, like you mentioned the notion of nation. I think this is something which develops in his thought and which becomes much more pronounced as he lives his life. Why? Because politics changes. And in particular, European politics is changing, and the role of the UK in Europe is changing, partly by the new members joining the European Union, and that opening up the borders between Central and Eastern Europe and the Western world, which had the consequence of a lot of migrants from this part of the world to that part, and a lot of other political issues that were brought up focused his interest on the nation, I think, step by step. And in fact, I would also claim that he becomes an early national conservative in his own way. Of course, we are aware of this movement of the recent years called national conservatism coming from the US over to Europe. And in fact, Scruton participated in the first gatherings of this movement. But much earlier, he was, as you mentioned, the Need of Nations and also England Analogy. These are books in which he presented a conservatism which had a national focus, which is not necessarily the case as far as conservatism is concerned. And in particular, not so frequent among British conservatism, because of course the empire is something which needs to be defended, or the United Kingdom, as opposed to any partial interests. But he becomes indeed a more English conservative, and in that respect, that is a new development, I think, in his thought. So these are the sort of shifts that comes up. But I don't think that any of the books that he will present on conservatism, including How to Be a Conservative or Conservatism, An Invitation to a Tradition, neither of these ones achieve what is a fully fledged conservative political philosophy.
If we could shift to the other part of the book, when you focus on his philosophy of art, as I've read that part, he understands art within as a kind of phenomenon within in the public sphere. And for him, the arts he focuses more are music and architecture. And you mentioned the influence of John Casey and David Watkins on Sir Roger. Could you elaborate how the figures of John Casey and David Watkins in a certain sense condition his view of art?
Yes. These are two Cambridge fellows and colleagues and friends of Roger in his early years when he researched on his PhD. John Casey is a literary historian and literary critic who helped him to open up his interests towards the classical Aristotelian, for example, Aristotelian ideas of art, as in the Poetics of Aristotle, but also towards the achievements of F.R. Lewis, literary historian, public intellectual, who was also quite influential of the day, and also they had a common interest in Wittgenstein. And his ideas of form of life and how it determines our philosophy. So John Casey is important for him to try to negotiate his views on aesthetics and the tradition of the great tradition and the contemporary English literature context. As for Watkin, I think he is even more important. David Watkin was an art historian and a historian of architecture, whose supervisor was Pevsner, who is perhaps the most important theorist of modernist architecture. And the relationship between Watkin and his supervisor was a kind of a rebellion, i.e. Watkin rebelling against his supervisor. Why? Because he found modern architecture simply ugly and trying to show that in architectural theory there is a great tradition that you have to rely on, going back to Vitruvius in the ancient context and to Alberti or Palladio in the early modern context. So And in that way, he had a major influence on Scruton, the art theoretician. But one more link. There is a connection between Watkin and Catholicism. And that's crucial to understand Roger Scruton's interest in religion already in those days, when he was yet a skeptical philosopher. And yet he came to understand the relevance of religion in this close friend and colleague's life and intellectual life. And that's something which becomes crucial in his later years. He published a volume with the title Our Church, which is the Anglican Church, and which becomes crucial in the last years of his life.
It's very interesting because, to a certain extent, he sees that when you are evaluating or contemplating art, you have to take account human nature, and this is particularly on the issue of architecture and that you build beautifully. How does that emphasis on the beauty of art emphasizes or conditions his strong critique of modernism and postmodernism within art? He seems to be very skeptical of what has happened, and that's why he, for example, was commissioned in this architecture building beautifully by the conservative, I think it was David Cameron's conservative government. What's the impact there?
Well, Let's start with the first half. Yes, indeed, architecture is crucial for him, but more important perhaps is urbanism, the idea of building for a whole community, for a city or a village or whatever human settlement we are talking about. So, in a sense, Scruton becomes an urban theoretician, who is quite interested in the Prince of Wales's experiment called Poundbury, this new plantation of a new quarter of a city. Which were to be built along traditional urban theories, like to be able to remain at a locality where you live, you can work, and you can find all the places that you want to attend ordinarily during your days. So in a way, for Scruton, this urban theoretical model, which comes again from Renaissance theoreticians, is crucial. And that's the reason why in 2019, he is the chair of this independent but governmentally supported committee, the Building Better, Building Beautiful committee. Again, we don't have here the time to talk about the politics behind it and the short interval then when he had to resign and then could come back. But the point is that he had there an opportunity to translate his theories to the practical. This is not a political position, but at least you can have an impact on what is going to happen in your society. So Scruton couldn't resist the challenge when this invitation came, and he at the very end of his life he was able to sum up his major proposals for the authorities how to return to an environment, a legal environment, a normative environment for new investments that could result in beautiful buildings. That's his idea. If you have the right legal environment, you will be able to influence builders to build more humane and more beautiful buildings.
It's so interesting because that again connects with his phenomenology of how to understand human experience and human relations. So he always talks about the we, but when he's trying to say, if I want to understand myself, we need to understand the other. So that's this emphasis on the we, and he deepens this idea in his later years and his philosophy, the idea what's the meaning of human life, and he talks a lot about of self-sacrifice and a kind of gratitude to what we have been given. So just one final question: if we can summarize the impact of Sir Roger Scruton as a philosopher, how would you summarize it?
Yes, well, of course, it's a very difficult task to do it in a short while, but let me try to do it by referring to two of his final works, The Face of God and The Soul of the World. These are two crucial lecture series that he gave at the end of in the last decade of his life, and that's where he tried to summarize his position. And his position concerning the meaning of human life, how to make our life meaningful. And to make it meaningful, we require language, because otherwise meaning is unavoidable for human consciousness. We need language, and language is a common achievement. It's something that is the achievement of a community, as we learn it from Wittgenstein and from others. And language is a part of our culture, and that's where culture is also crucial, i.e. that a community produces certain things that will live on when the individuals die for the next generation. And this connects one generation with the other, which is crucial for him along the Burkean lines, that in fact society is this compact between the dead, the living, and the unborn. And culture is the connection, the bridge that connects. And in particular, architecture is crucial. Why? Because architecture is the built environment of the community that we see each day, that we live in, and that determines our life in very characteristic ways. So we need to be able to get involved in our culture, in our community, in order to live a meaningful life, and therefore we have to make sacrifices. Individuals have to sacrifice some parts of their freedom, in fact, in favor of the community, in order to reserve that freedom which belongs to the community and which will feed back and give you back your own freedom. Your freedom is part of the freedom of your community. And in that way, you have to be aware of the role that the community plays in your life, And finally, you have to be aware that even your community is not the final reference point for the meaning of your life. The final reference point is, in fact, to understand that all human beings are similar. Why? Because they are all created on the image of God. And in this respect, in order to make sense of our life as a life of a human being, we need to be able to appreciate the createdness of the human being. And in this way, our gratitude is not only towards the others, towards the community, but also towards God. And that's where his final comments on self-sacrifice and gratitude connects to the major metaphysical issues of divine, the loyalty and the piety towards the divine.
Thank you. I think if we can summarize, I think you summarize as best how you end the book with the words to feel at home in the world. And I think and Sir Roger's book on green philosophy, I think it's a very good example to feel at home in the world. Just one last question, Professor Hosha. What's next? What's your next research project? What you're working on?
Yes, feeling at home and oikophilia, the concept of oikophilia, we cannot forget about that. As for my recent research, I have got a contract with Palgrave to produce a book with the provisional title, An Aristotelian Philosophy of Civility. So my interest this time is in the concept of civility, which I take as closely connected to an aspect of conservatism, which is that, in fact, in order to have, communities are difficult to govern. Why? Because individuals have different interests and different background, different motivations. You have to coordinate them. And the way to best coordinate human beings is to try to teach them, to learn them, to educate them into the norms that you want them to follow. And that is what civility is about. It's, in fact, a kind of often unreflective knowledge of the norms that we want to follow, which are not legally binding, but which are achieving coordination among individuals in a community, and which are therefore crucial to have flourishing communities, as Aristotle talks about the polis. So that's my project. It's a real challenge, and I'm still working hard to try to build it up in a convincing manner. There is a lot of discussion recently about civility on both sides of the political spectrum. So I have to be very careful and delicately nuanced in order to contribute to that rich discussion, but I try to do my best.
A much needed discussion on civility. I think modern politics needs a dose of civility, and I think Sir Roger is a good example of an English gentleman that of the importance of being in a society governed in a certain sense by a sense of civility. Thank you, Professor Hosha, for being with us. The book is Arts and Politics in Roger Scruton's Conservative Philosophy, from Palgrave Studies Series in Classical Liberalism, from Palgrave Macmillan. Until next time.
Thank you very much.